The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Werke, Judge Smith, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, December 14th, 2022. We have four cases on the calendar today, two of which are scheduled for oral argument. As noted, I am Sarah Wheelock, and presenting on a panel with Judges Renee Werke and Tracy Smith. This morning, we are holding our hearings on zoom.gov, and please allow me to address a few things in our virtual format before we start. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of the arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals website, which is on the Judicial Branch's website. I'll also note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of oral argument unless you have received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with specific conditions that were established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. So with that, Marshall, please call the first case this morning.
This is case number A221068, Charlotte Kapiski Appellant versus IMT Insurance Company Respondent.
Counsel, you'll notice that there should be a clock in at least one square of your screen, and it will reset according to the time you have for your argument. As you're probably already aware, appellant will have 15 minutes for their initial argument, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have the last word with 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument so the recording is clear, as well as pronouncing your name and your client's name so we know how you'd like us to refer to each of you this morning. And also remember when you're not speaking to mute yourself when you're making argument. If anybody has any difficulty with technology at any point, please let us know and we'll do everything we can to pause and try and help. We want to make sure that we hear from everyone this morning. So please, again, state your name and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jeffrey Montpetit, M-O-N-T-P-E-T-I-T, on behalf of appellant Charlotte Kapiski this morning. Your Honors, the facts of this case are not in dispute. There is no fact dispute before this court. The parties have stipulated to the policy at issue, and really all that is before the court is a legal determination. The legal determination that was originally made by Judge Eric Hilden in this matter is flawed, is erred. We're asking that he be reversed, Your Honors. On page 4 of Judge Hilden's opinion memorandum, he writes, "No notice could be required for what was already a part of the policy. The court must apply the insurance contract as it is written." Both of those statements are contrary to existing precedent here in Minnesota. The first part of that, no notice could be required for what was already a part of the policy, is contrary to Canadian Pacific, Benton, and Stoltenberg, all of which are heavily cited in our brief. The second part of this, the court must apply the insurance contract as it is written, is just simply false. If that were true, there would never be such thing as a declaratory judgment action, and there wouldn't be all of these cases discussing whether or not the policy was flawed or there was an error. And I'm going to begin, Your Honors, with talking about the endorsement, the amendment of policy provisions contained in the Wadena policy.
I'm going to ask you a question before you even get going.
Sure.
You know, you're relying heavily on Canadian Universal, and I disagree with you because, as I understand the record, the endorsement policy was always there. As you know, Canadian Pacific, they had a policy, and then the terms were altered after the fact. But what I'm getting at is, are you asserting now that there was a change during this policyholder's term?
I'm not asserting that there's a change, Your Honor. And Your
But if
Honor.
that's the case, how would Canadian Pacific be supportive to your client's position? Notice.
Because Canadian Pacific is the case that really primes the well on providing notice, Your Honor, of what would be a drop down or a step down provision contained within the policy. Canadian Pacific says, we think the law is well established that an insurer must convey to the insured an explanation of the provisions of his insurance policy in terms which he can comprehend. It is now firmly settled that insurance contracts are contracts of adhesion between parties not equally situated. Here's the important part.
Go ahead.
Consequently, the insurer, as the dominant and expert party in the field, must not only draft such contracts in unambiguous terms, but must bring to the attention of the insured all provisions and conditions which create exceptions or limitations on the coverage. And that's exactly what we have here.
Counsel, let me just ask, though, apropos of what Judge Workey was talking about, I mean, if we look at the court's own syllabus point in Canadian Universal, you know, written by the court, it states when an insurer by renewal of a policy or by endorsement to an existing insurance policy substantially reduces the prior insurance coverage, there's an affirmative duty to give notice. I mean, it seems like the court's own description of its own holding has to do with prior insurance, a change from a prior insurance. And it seems to me that what you're arguing more falls in the neighborhood of either ambiguity or, you know, existing rules about ambiguity in interpreting a contract, or the reasonable expectations doctrine, which I don't see that you briefed. So I'm not really sure, besides sort of general principles about insurance law and Canadian Universal, that it actually supplies a rule that's applicable to your case.
Your Honor, it is absolutely applicable, because I think where the court is drawing its confusion is the court is actually hinging on the fact that it's a renewal.
What bothers me is that it seems in your briefing and your argument that you're wanting us to extend the rule. And I understand with good reason, I understand, you know, the claim your client is making, but I'm not sure that we're the right court to do that. I think that perhaps falls within the Supreme Court domain or our legislative body across the street. Does that not make us expand the existing rule of law as established?
No, I don't see it as expanding the rule of law one bit, Your Honors, because the court did exactly what I'm proposing in Stoltenberg. And there, the court said, regardless of the policyholder's duty to read the policy, and regardless of the fact that step-down provisions have been upheld as consistent with the law, an insurer still has a duty to provide adequate notice to the policyholder of a substantial reduction in coverage.
Wasn't Stoltenberg more of a consumer protection case, though? I mean, having to do with a non-resident?
Well, the question here is whether or not Wadena needs to provide notice of a substantial reduction in coverage. And we agree there was no notice provided. And if we take the holding from Stoltenberg, which says unequivocally, an insurer still has a duty to provide adequate notice to the policyholder of a substantial reduction in coverage, then what rules are we applying? Are we applying?
So in Stoltenberger, was that a change from an existing policy? Reduction in coverage.
It was a reduction in coverage, correct?
In other words, there was a previous policy, and then there was a new policy that reduced it.
Correct.
So what is, and then in that case, so what you're, tell me what you think, besides just having, you know, the general rules that there should, that about contract, interpreting a contract and ambiguity and ambiguous terms, you know, are read against the insurer, et cetera. I mean, what is it that you're specifically arguing should happen in a case like this, where there's a single contract that has an endorsement that changes, amends some of the terms of the base form? What are you arguing has to happen? A separate written notice, separate from the contract endorsement itself? Tell me what you mean by notice that makes this somehow different from just generally interpreting an insurance contract.
Exactly. I'm arguing exactly what Stoltenberg says, Your Honor.
And tell me what that is. That should have been done.
It needs to be conspicuous and clear to the policyholder that they're within the policy, within these 92 pages buried in at page 58, which amounts to 34 words, that there is a substantial change to the coverage, reducing the coverage limits from $100,000 to $30,000.
So as I understood what was happening, and maybe I'm wrong, in Canadian, Universal, et cetera, those cases where there's a change, it's not enough for the insurer when they make a substantial change just to send a policy that incorporates that substantial change. They have to give an additional notice. Hey, let me point out to you this change. But what you're essentially arguing is that this contract itself, where the change, as you would describe it, or the amendment, is built into the contract, you don't think there needs to be a separate writing. You're just arguing that it wasn't sufficiently conspicuous to give to inform the insured that the coverage is limited as it is. Is that right? There doesn't need to be a separate writing.
That is 100% correct. The argument here, Your Honor, is that you can't, that Wadena can't get away with a deceptive reduction in coverage.
Aren't you then arguing, I mean, this is the reasonable expectation doctrine. What you're saying is, here we have unsophisticated, I don't mean any derogatory term, because believe me, I'm not sure what's in my own insurance policy. But what you're saying is that your client was unaware that this was there. So it was a reasonable expectation that when your face page, your declaration page says 100,000, that would in fact be what was in the document, in the fine print, it was something less. Is that what you're saying, the reasonable expectation doctrine?
No, I'm not arguing reasonable expectation doctrine, Your Honor. I'm arguing from the trio of cases that say you need to give conspicuous notice when there's a substantial reduction in coverage that's buried in the policy and you're not making it known to the policyholder or the insured. And it's saying it maybe a different way, that, you know, the carrier does not get a sort of a free fool me pass by burying a reduction in coverage in the policy. That's not what these cases stand for.
So, counsel, I am curious, you keep saying it's buried in the policy. As I understand it, the second page of the declarations included a box that specifically said that the endorsements were made a part of the policy. So it seems that it was at least identified earlier in the pages that your clients had. And so explain how, just address that point for me.
Well, you know, that point, Your Honor, again, just looking again back at Stoltenberg, because, you know, I think that is the real pinnacle case, but that checking a box saying there's an endorsement does not equivocate to being conspicuous to the policyholder. If simply checking a box would meet the guidelines established in Stoltenberg for being conspicuous to the policyholder, then I lose. But there is nothing about checking a box on an endorsement for an insophisticated when it comes to insurance policies, an elderly couple in northern Minnesota, to let them know that there's a substantial reduction in their coverage. And in fact, Your Honors, there really is, and I think the question here is there any case that holds an insurer upon issuing a policy or renewing a policy is under no obligation to alert insureds of an endorsement that significantly reduces the coverage amount shown on the declaration page? There is no case that stands for that proposition. None. The cases actually are contrary to that. And again, this is the what primes the well on this, and it's a sort of an evolutionary concept, is Canadian Pacific. But by the time we get to this court's opinion, written by Judge Hallbrooks last year, it's clear and unequivocal what these cases hold, which is an insurer still has a duty, not a suggestion, it's a duty to provide adequate notice to the policyholder of a substantial reduction in coverage.
So let me ask, I mean, I know you don't want to be in this realm, and I know we're trying to force you in it, that this is not really a Canadian universal realm, a change in coverage so much as it is reading the policy as written. And I'm, believe me, again, like I'm highly sympathetic to the idea that doesn't insured actually understand, you know, what this means, but, you know, and, but we are dealing with Minnesota case law. We have Fry that found a step down provision enforceable. We have an unpublished decision in Johnson. I know these things, finding the same. I know it's in the reasonable expectations realm, but are you suggesting then for any exclusion that changes, you know, might eliminate coverage or change the coverage, et cetera, that, I mean, what it sounds like you're asking us to create a rule that's perhaps different from what these rules would tell us in this case, that it's unambiguous and not contrary to reasonable expectations.
The rule, Your Honor, is substantial reduction in coverage, that the carrier has a duty to provide adequate notice to the policyholder of a substantial reduction in coverage.
What does that mean for other types of exclusions, like an intentional act exclusion or a, you know, sexual misconduct exclusion or other types of exclusions that might appear in the exclusions setting, which is, I think,
I don't
perhaps
think it,
oddly where this one appeared, but
I don't think that it has any effect. I don't think there's any effect on those other exclusions, Your Honor. This endorsement is a substantial reduction in coverage, no different than what was in Stoltenberg. And if the premise is what triggers the notice is the substantial reduction, then that rule should be applied uniformly. I mean, what difference does it make if it's a renewal?
And the rule is that it must be conspicuous. That's
correct.
That's,
correct.
And active. So does a exclusion that, I guess, is the answer to my question that, for example, an intentional acts exclusion, for example, is that reducing coverage or no? I'm trying to figure out, like, that's just not eliminating coverage. So it's not reducing coverage.
You know, and Your Honors, I take no issue with the fact that, you know, as they say in Stoltenberg, that there are step down provisions that have been upheld, that there's a duty for the insurer to read their policy. I take no issues with that, much like the court in Stoltenberg. That's all very true. But really here, the question becomes, and to answer your question, Your Honor, is if there's a substantial reduction in the coverage limits, i.e. the dollars, a notice must be sent, conspicuous notice. There was no notice sent in this case. None. And in fact, all of these other cases, Fry,
Mr. Monpetit, you'll have 5 additional minutes.
Sure.
You do want to follow up on that. That's okay. I know sometimes it's harder on Zoom to see the clock, but you will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. So we'll turn to counsel for respondent next. The clock is reset. So please begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kevin Kennedy on behalf of respondent IMT Insurance Company. Your Honors, at the trial court level, originally IMT Insurance Company was the party being sued. That was amended by agreement of counsel. The correct defendant in the trial court is Wadena Insurance Company. Wadena is the company that issued the policy at issue here. Your Honors, this appeal is about one thing. It's about appellant Ms. Kopiski's efforts to broadly expand the rule set out by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Canadian Universal Insurance Company versus Firewatch. In the insurance defense industry, we call that the Firewatch rule. And that was the case that actually was first set the notice provision when there was a substantial reduction in coverage.
Counsel, may I ask, what do you take that notice provision or requirement to be, a separate notice from the insurance policy itself?
It is. It's very clear from the Canadian Universal or Firewatch case that's what it is. The court use the term significant reduction in coverage in a temporal sense, recognizing that if there is a change in a policy, either by renewal or by a subsequent endorsement to an existing policy, there is an added duty, if you will, to notify the policyholder of that reduction in coverage.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again. Would that also apply to something that brought the coverage down to zero, like we're adding a new exclusion?
If it were considered a significant reduction in coverage, I think it would.
Right. You go from full coverage to zero coverage. It sounds like a reduction that would be a good idea to send a notice to the policy.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. But the key, and appellant's brief says there's no temporal aspect to the Canadian universal case. That's just not so. I mean, it's very clear, and the court mentioned the syllabus. It is clear in the words chosen that the linchpin of that holding was there a policy that provided coverage and a subsequent policy or a change by endorsement or renewal, which substantially reduced the coverage? That's the linchpin for the notice requirement. So what the court did in Canadian Universal is actually a trade-off. It recognized the rule that insureds have an obligation to read their policy and that an unambiguous policy must be interpreted per its plain language and enforced as written, because that was the bargain between the parties. But in the case where there is a substantial reduction in coverage, the court stepped in and said, we're going to give the consumer, whether it's a commercial policyholder or a personal lines policyholder, we're going to have this requirement that the insurance company explain itself, make sure that it's noticed. So the term significant reduction in coverage is key. The term reduction means a change in the policy from initial inception of the policy to a subsequent change. So for Ms., the initial policy issued by Wadena in 2016 and the renewal policy issued in 2017 are identical with respect to the liability drop-down provision that's at issue in this case. So there has been, as a matter of law, no reduction in coverage. Minnesota courts have also long held that insurance policies must be read as a whole. What appellant wants to do is say, I'm looking at the deck sheet, and that's all I'm looking at. That's not the law in Minnesota, and that's not what an insured is held to. They're held to have read the policy, and that is presumed under the law. The law also says you can't rewrite a policy that is unambiguous. Quite honestly, Your Honors, appellant's argument has no law that supports its position to broaden the firewatch notice provision to the very inception of the policy. And that's what they're asking for. In the brief, that's exactly what appellant said is that they want this court, the Court of Appeals, to require insurers to alert insureds of significant reductions in coverage at the inception of the policy. The law simply doesn't support it. Fry clearly says drop-down provisions are valid and enforceable. We've talked about the reasonable expectations doctrine. Mr. Montpetit has said that's not what he's arguing, but the case law is even clear that even that bastion of hope for most insureds on coverage, reasonable expectations, is of no avail here. The drop-down provision in Fry was found in the exclusions section of the policy. Therefore, it wasn't hidden in some inconspicuous definition section of the policy. The Fry court rejected the reasonable expectations doctrine. The next case that I think is really important, Your Honors, is Babinski, the Eighth Circuit case. That case was not even mentioned by appellants in either one of their briefs. and it's an extremely analogous case. The auto policy drop-down provision was found not to be ambiguous, even though the specific amount of coverage that it was reduced to was not in the policy. And Babinski cited to agency rent-a-car, which is a Minnesota state court case. It also rejected the applicability of the reasonable expectations doctrine, saying it's not ambiguous, it's not a hidden exclusion. Johnson versus Ironshore Indemnity, that's an unpublished decision, so it's not precedent, but it is persuasive. Just like in this case, the drop-down provision was located in an endorsement. The drop-down provision was found not to be ambiguous, not hidden, and not misleading. So there's no law that supports appellant's argument for this broadening of the Canadian Universal versus Firewatch rule. But appellant relies heavily on Stoltenberg, and that reliance is misplaced. Stoltenberg is, first of all, an unpublished decision and is not precedent. It involves an underinsured motorist or UIM drop-down provision in an auto policy. What appellant doesn't tell you, Your Honors, is that Stoltenberg, the whole purpose of that case depended upon an addition to the policy 8 years after inception. In 1997, Stoltenberg had a policy, and 8 years later in 2005 was when an endorsement was added to the policy that caused a substantial change, a reduction in coverage. The focus of Stoltenberg was whether the notice of the reduction in coverage was sufficient. So the insurer in Stoltenberg understood the Canadian Universal Notice Rule. And the only question in Stoltenberg was whether the notice was sufficient. It has zero applicability to the facts of our case. Citing to the Firewatch or Canadian Universal versus Firewatch case,
I'm interrupting, but I just want to tell you thank you, because I didn't understand when you were referring to Firewatch in your brief and so on, you say in the industry, but I'm used to it the other way around. I throw you off track entirely.
No,
I just
not at all, Your Honor. I learned, right or wrong, as a young lawyer that when there's an insurance company in the name of the case, you don't use it. You use the one that's less common, like Firewatch, which is actually a catchy phrase. So that's why it caught on in our insurance defense industry.
It is, and now I get it. Thank you.
So the court in Stoltenberg said, citing to Canadian Universal, the court says new limitations on coverage must be prominently placed and clearly phrased such that the policyholder is apprised that coverage is being significantly decreased. Okay. Appellant quotes a passage from Stoltenberg that is completely out of context. Appellant claims that this unpublished decision from the Court of Appeals clarified the Supreme Court holding in Canadian Universal. I don't know, but I don't think that's legally possible for the Court of Appeals in an unpublished decision to clarify the Supreme Court holding. Interpret it? Yes. Clarify? No. The court in Stoltenberg referenced the consumer protection principle embodied in Canadian Universal and then quoted from it. And this is what appellant relies on. This is the distilled moment of this appellate argument. In Canadian Universal, the Supreme Court established that an insurer has an obligation to inform the insured by cover letter or a conspicuous heading to the amendatory endorsement or some similar means that the endorsement contains significant changes in coverage and offer to explain and discuss the significance of the changes to the insured upon request. This quote, Your Honors, is referencing the endorsement that the insurer added 8 years after policy inception. The quote read in isolation, as appellant is trying to do, is misleading. A simple review of Canadian Universal establishes that the Supreme Court had no intention of applying its holding beyond the context of a reduction in coverage occurring after the policy was first issued. Appellant cites no Minnesota decision applying Canadian Universal to an insurer whose endorsement at inception was identical to the endorsement at the time of the motor vehicle accident or occurrence, which is what we have here.
Can I ask a question? I know it's like off topic, perhaps the argument a little bit, but I believe there are some states perhaps that have legislated in this area. I don't know if you know, and step down provisions. I'm wondering what is the, restricted or perhaps actually prohibited them. My understanding, is that we don't have legislation on it in Minnesota. Certainly that would have been part of this case otherwise. What's the rationale for a step down provision to eliminate coverage? I think sometimes it's for family members, sometimes for people other than family members. I mean, it does seem a little surprising when you think, oh, I have coverage up to this amount. I know this made me immediately go to my auto insurer to see whether there's a step down provision in my auto insurance. What is the rationale for such a thing?
So if you look at it historically, those step down provisions were an effort to avoid collusion or fraud among family members or friends.
Is it steps down for family?
Yes. There was just too much opportunity for fraud with having one car accidents and people in the same vehicle wanting to sue their husband or their child and having all this insurance coverage available to them. And that's really that's what motivated it. And the courts have upheld it.
Yeah, it just seems also those are the people most likely to be with you and injured in a car with you. The people you'd be most likely to get a claim from are the people who ride with you routinely.
Well, that's true. But in most auto accidents, you're suing a third-party tortfeasor. You're suing someone who hit you, who T-boned you, not your spouse. But that is the reason behind it. And there's other provisions in insurance policies that reduce coverage and reduce coverage in that sense. For example, in the property coverage, the deck page says you have personal property coverage of $200,000. But if you look in the policy in the special limits section, it says for firearms, all you get is $2,500. And those are routinely upheld. They're unambiguous, they're clear. The insured has a duty to read their policy as long as it's not a hidden or unambiguous provision. And the courts have clearly said these drop-down provisions are absolutely unambiguous, whether they're in the exclusion section of the policy or whether they're in an endorsement to the policy, okay? So Judge Hilden, I'll finish with this, Your Honors. Judge Hilden at the trial court level ruled correctly, and he was very succinct. There was no change in the policy which would require notice to the insurance. He followed the Canadian Universal Rule to a T. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. So we will have 5 minutes added to the clock. And then once that's up and ready, you can begin your rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. What the appellee would have this court believe and understand is that when you try to substantially reduce coverage the first time, you don't need to give notice. But if you do it subsequent, you need to give notice. That's inconsistent.
I just think that there's a difference in between the parties and maybe even what I understood your argument to be about what notice means. I mean, I think notice in Canadian Universal means a notice separate from the policy. And I think as I understand your argument today, you're saying no, that notice means just that it has to be clear in the policy. There's no requirement of a separate notice. I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong there, but that's what I understood your argument at the start earlier, your principal argument, is that there's no requirement of a separate notice. It just needs to be clear in the policy.
What the cases really indicate, Your Honor, is that the notice needs to be a separate letter.
All right. Is that what you're arguing, that there needs to be a separate letter, yes, even with the initial policy? I think I might have misunderstood you in your principal argument. Correct.
If I wasn't clear in that, okay, I apologize. But there needs to be a separate letter that indicates to the policyholder that there's going to be a substantial reduction in coverage. Now, I would submit to this court that it is completely inconsistent to say you can get away with it the first time. But if there's a change, a substantial reduction, well, then you have to give the notice.
What should the notice be in a case like this where it's an initial thing is, please read carefully endorsement 010013 to see how it changes the declarations. I mean, what does it need to say in your view?
You know, in my view, Your Honor, it's very interesting. The court has noted already that they've had to go back and look at their own policies to say, do I have this in there? Oh, my gosh, I have no idea. And we take people up in northern Minnesota, elderly couples who are getting, you know, sort of bamboozled by the same thing. And that notice needs to clearly and unequivocally let the policyholder know that if there's an issue or there's an accident, their deck page says 100, but that isn't true. It's going to be 30. At what point?
So should there be a letter for every type of exclusion or endorsement that reduces either to zero or to something less than the declaration? On top of the policy itself, there should be a letter as to each of those provisions?
That's not what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is when the policy at issue here says it's going to be reduced to the Minnesota financial responsibility minimums, they need to make that clear.
Would your rule be limited just to this type of reduction, I wonder? There could be myriad types of reductions, including down to zero of coverage, right? That applies, that is in exceptions or exclusions or definitions or, you know, I mean, we see these, you talk about why do we wouldn't have any litigation and insurance coverage. Obviously there's boatloads of litigation over what an insurance policy means. And it's usually, no, there's no coverage or zero coverage or this exception or definition or exclusion applies.
Yeah. And I think, Your Honor, your question hinges on, you know, what is the rule of law that the court applies here? And I would submit to the court that Frye, Babinski, and Johnson have nothing to do with the analysis here, because the analysis in those cases wasn't about receiving notice as it is here. And moreover, the Stoltenberg case, which, yes, is unpublished, it's persuasive authority, but, you know, Judge Hallbrooks, you know, hit the nail on the head when she said an insurer still has a duty to provide adequate notice to the policyholder of a substantial reduction in coverage. It just needs to be a letter informing the insured, hey, buried within this policy, which you're not going to understand, your 100 becomes 30.
So I just follow up on, I think, Judge Smith's question. I'm curious then, what happens to the obligation of the insured to read their policy? You're saying it's in the policy, but you want an additional letter. The letter theoretically could be as difficult to understand for a layperson. So I'm just wondering what that does to the obligation to actually read your policy.
Well, Your Honor, I could write that letter so that my 15-year-old would understand it. That wouldn't be that difficult of a task to do. But, you know, again, as in the persuasive case, Judge Hallbrooks again said, regardless of the policyholder's duty to read the policy, the carrier has a duty to provide the notice of a substantial reduction in coverage. And I would submit that the policy as it is written here, to answer your question, Judge Wheelock, that is not notice, not one bit. And we would ask that this court reverse Judge Hilden.
Thank you. And thanks to both of the counsel for being here today and for your argument. It has been very helpful. The briefs were helpful as well. The case is submitted and an opinion will be issued in the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.